Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Welcome back to Write on Four Corners. I'm your host, Delcherie Gladden. I'm an author of over 30 published novels. And on this week's episode, I have Catherine Young, who's going to be talking about her memoir, Black Diamonds, A Childhood Colored by Coal. Catherine, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Well, as you said, my name is Catherine Young, and I'm coming to you from the hills in southwest Wisconsin near the Mississippi River, where I farm and work as an ecologist in my home, and I write about place and I write about land. And I'm originally from the largest coal mining valley in the world in northeastern Pennsylvania. And that's why I'm here to talk about the book that I created, the memoir Black Diamonds, which was published by Torrey House Press, and it was released this fall.
Thank you for mentioning Torrey House Press, because that's how I got connected with you. Typically, the show is for writers from the Southwest, people writing about the Southwest, and publishers from the Southwest. So Torrey House is based in Utah, and I'd had the opportunity to read Scott Graham's newest book, kind of put me in touch with them, and they were so kind to send me a box of books to start interviewing more authors. And yours was one of them. And I have really enjoyed reading Black Diamonds and getting to know more about the area and the history, because this was really kind of a new topic for me. I really didn't know very much about the history of coal mining, and I was pretty shocked by a lot of it, to be honest.
In what way were you shocked, or why were you shocked?
The complete lack of, I guess, awareness of safety and the damage that a lot of the aspects of that was causing to the people and the environment and the town, and just how much wasn't known. And I guess some of it probably was known and they were aware, but like, we really didn't have a lot of those protections in place at that time. And you're telling it through the story of your experiences and the people you know, and you actually get to really see those real effects on the people. I did not realize how much of an impact it had in so many ways, but particularly in those ways that it affected, you know, the actual people who lived around those mining areas. I was not very knowledgeable about that, so this has been eye-opening.
It's so true that where I grew up was a hidden place. We thought of ourselves as really essential to the United States and to North America, which we were, because it's the place where the Industrial Revolution began. The book looks at my childhood through the eyes of the child. It also gives the visceral experience, the embodied experience of living with coal and living on that landscape. At the same time, there's a second narrative woven in, and that's about a famous painting called the Lackawanna Valley. That painting is in the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. The painter George Innes began the painting in 1855. He was commissioned by a railroad that was beginning, the Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western Railroad. And in the 1850s, there was this realization by the Scranton family that they could use their iron and make rails for railroads, and they could use the coal and power the locomotives, the steam locomotives. And this was in a very steep and narrow valley, so it's not a place that people would pass through unless they took a train there, which a lot of people did over time. Part of the reason I wrote this is because I feel this history would be lost unless I tell these stories, having lived it. I'm on the younger end of people who saw the demise of coal in that valley, and I feel a great need to tell the stories. And one way to tell the story about land, about place, is through the people. And I'm so grateful to you for saying that you were interested in how it affected the people.
I'm someone who, in my own writing and in books that I look for, character is really important to me. And telling stories through people, I think, is just something that, I look for and I enjoy as a reader and as a writer. And that was a really wonderful part of this book. I did learn a lot, just in general, about the history and the progress of coal in that area and its demise and everything. That part was absolutely fascinating as well. But the people and the stories really brought all of the information to life for me, because they were the ones living through it and seeing those changes. And I have to say, like, you have a really wonderful ability to capture a moment with your description and to really make a lasting impression. I kept getting caught in those as I was reading and just having to stop. I really felt like I was part of the moment. You do a really great job of describing the emotions and the visual aspects of some of your memories, which was just really wonderful, and I wanted to make sure to tell you that.
Oh, thank you so much. I really do have a visual memory, and that's part of the reason why this book involves a painting. I was on a landscape. I want to describe it a little bit for everyone to hear. There was so much coal in that valley, the anthracite coal, the hard coal, that it lined the roadways. It lined the railroad beds of the 6 railroads that came in the valley and took the coal away. And even crushed coal lined the alleyways of our city of Scranton, Pennsylvania. The other thing that happened was the mines, some of them caught on fire beneath us, and the waste piles of coal, which were 5 to 10 stories tall, they caught on fire. So a lot of my childhood is a memory of smoke, of flames. There were houses that collapsed into the mine. There were houses that were condemned because they were just too poisonous to be in because of the burning mines underneath or the proximity to the burning waste coal, the column dump. And I want to give this picture that there were these conical mountains, and they were pink rust ash mountains. And then they were smoking all day long. And at night, if you happened to be near them, you would see these ghostly blue flames covering them. It was something that we didn't want to get next to. They were down in the valley. I lived in a gorge a little bit away from that, a mile away. But we were all affected by the smoke all the time. We were affected by the emergencies all the time. So that was a lot of my childhood, but I was a very imaginative child, and I loved to read and I loved to make stories up. One of the things that caught me as a little girl was this famous painting, The Lackawanna Valley by George Ennis. There are people a few years older than me who told me that the painting came to the valley one time and they saw it. There are different people who've said this. No one has a record of it, but they saw it. And I believe I saw the real painting then when I was a child. And then I looked for it in textbooks when I was a little girl in school, because if you could see this scene, it's so lovely. You see a tree, you see a boy reclining on the ground, you see tree stumps, and you see he's watching cattle. But then you see a steam locomotive from the 1850s crossing the river. And when that steam locomotive crosses that river, that is the moment of the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. That's why the painting is so important. And the reason why the painting was made was because of a railroad that wanted to advertise itself, whether they actually had the equipment or not. And behind this locomotive, you see the beginnings of the city. And in the background, you see these mountains. So as a little girl, I saw these beautiful colors. It looked like farmland. It looked like something I wanted to be in. And I knew it was my home place. And I was always trying to figure out where the boy sat and where Ennis made the painting. Was it on my side of the valley? And was it close to my house? Because I just wanted to enter that scene. I didn't want to be in the scene of all the smoke, the burning, the waste coal everywhere. I wanted to be with these beautiful pastels. That is a lot of the story, is my journey with the Ennis painting, because I wanted to know more about the Ennis painting. So that's the adult voice in the memoir. But then there's the child voice of walking everywhere, because my mother didn't drive. So I walked everywhere with her, miles and miles every day. So we might walk to a garment factory and pick up rags to make rag rugs, or we might go visiting someone, or we might go to a relative's house and bake or can tomatoes, or we might be standing in a relief line. All those things were true. And it was a beautiful way to tell the story, is just as it was, that I was a young child and I was always walking with my mother, because that's how we interacted with our place.
Well, you get so much of the visual aspect of where you're living. And like you said, the coal lining the street, everything being a little bit tied in just by the debris and the little bits and pieces that spread throughout town. Those small details really set the scene and helped impress throughout each of your stories how much coal was a part of just every single moment and how it really couldn't be escaped. It was just, yeah. It was there. It was so present in everything that was going on in just regular day-to-day life.
It was so present along with the trains. I mean, that's the other important piece in this, because the rails were made there to go across the country. The railroads came through. There were 6 railroads that developed. But that means that when my mother and I were walking places, we were always corralled by tracks. We had to cross gorges. We were always crossing bridges. There were tracks underneath the bridges. There were trestles over us. There was even a tunnel in my neighborhood where a train went through for a mile and came out the other end from one end of the gorge over to where the cemetery was, where all my relatives were buried. The reality was coal was also always on the move. We saw the coal cars, 100 cars at a time leaving the valley. We could hear them in our dreams, because the valley had a 10% grade on the railroad. That's very, very steep for a railroad. So it meant that there were 4 locomotives pulling the train and 4 in back pushing. And we could hear that all the time. So we were living the trains and the coal. It was a very, intense experience. The other piece about the coal is that everything was made of coal. We heated our houses. Some people cooked on coal stoves. The gas that was used in the stoves was manufactured from anthracite coal, and a lot of other things like the dyes in our clothes, our medicines. It was that era. And because we were in this valley that was kind of tucked away, we were still living with, let's say, an older fashioned way of life. A lot of the things I lived as a child were very 19th century, but really nothing progressed beyond the 1940s, and I grew up in the 1960s.
Well, that's such an interesting aspect of it, because you describe how coal starts declining in your area. Yeah. And the company, the main company, kind of moves to a new location and things start ramping down in a lot of ways. And when that's something that's a huge part of the community's economy and what's holding everything together, it really did bring things to a standstill in a lot of ways. A lot of that progress and innovation and money coming in and jobs, it just slowly started disappearing. And that has major effects on a town. But we're seeing that here in northern New Mexico, where, you know, we used to be mining and oil and gas, and most of that is gone at this point. And this whole community is really trying to figure out, well, okay, what do we do now? Like, what are we if we're not, you know, an oil and gas boom and bust town, that we're really just at the tail end of all of that? It's not coming back at this point. And that's a hard thing for a town, for people to adjust from, to change their identity and just figure out where to go next.
That's a really important thing you just said. Yes, having lived that, we didn't want to admit that we were losing everything. It was a gradual decline. It was really slow. I could say that it really started happening just around the time I was born. And in the first 10 years of my life, pretty much everything disappeared. You know, the railroads that were there were gone. A lot of our downtown buildings burned down mysteriously. Coal wasn't being so actively mined. It just went on and on and on. But it didn't stop. It kept happening. And I went back there in the mid-1980s, and I was so shocked that a huge high school that was packed to the gills with 1,200 students downtown was closed. The Sonic Temple, which was the Philharmonic Orchestra's home and where I had played in youth symphony, that was closed. The huge Gothic library, this beautiful building, that was closed. All of these structures that were put in place before the year 1900 were finally gone. Things have changed in a different direction now, but at that time, it was very, very grim.
What a shocking thing to come home to. That had to be, a weird feeling.
It was hard in some ways, and in other ways, it wasn't very much of a surprise. I left because things were ending. Now, but I left also for another reason, and that is in the 1970s, there was the beginning of the environmental movement. And actually, when I was in fifth grade, there was the beginning of the ecology movement in 1968. And that all began with someone in Wisconsin, and Earth Day began in Wisconsin. And then at the university here in Madison, Wisconsin, there was an environmental studies program. I knew as a child that I wanted to make a change. I didn't want to live with this kind of situation where we have the boom and bust, where we have extraction. I wanted to find something else. I heard about renewable energy. I heard about these other possibilities. And so I came to Wisconsin to learn about environmental studies and work with that as best I can. It turns out after all these years, the most powerful thing I can do is tell stories. And the hardest story for me to tell was where I was from, because it was so grim. I didn't even tell some of the hardest stories, but it's a pretty grim situation. On the other hand, maybe you can attest for me, Cherie, because the book is not a downer.
Absolutely not, no.
No. I mean, because just like any place, people and families always try to find celebrations through food, right? Mm. They always try to find their recreation together. And so even though it was hard, that's what we did. And even something as simple as sitting on porches telling stories, which we did a lot, which is the reason I could become a writer, because we told so many stories. That was our main entertainment for a long time.
Well, it's wonderful to see how much of that really helped shape your interest in who you are and what you ended up doing. It's so interesting, I think, just the idea of how we become who we are over time. And that was another interesting aspect of your book is checking out your bio and seeing where you're at now and looking at a little bit of your history and then actually getting to dive into what brought you to the point that you're at now talking to me here. And it was really fun to see that you use both your child's voice in relating some of these memories, and then you have sections where you're talking as adult you and sharing some of those perspectives and the information. And you get this really neat viewpoint of what this all looked like to you growing up, and then how you're seeing it as an adult and seeing how everything kind of comes together. I found that to be a really fun and interesting aspect of reading your book, of seeing those little puzzle pieces come together throughout your life. And a lot of really unique stories of things that I think you grew up with and experienced that a lot of other people didn't, that those were foreign things to them. But being able to see them through that familiar perspective of you growing up in the middle of this very unique place during a time that was so transitional and impactful, it seems, for you especially, but I would guess for a lot of the people in that area.
You know, when I was a child, we did watch television. And let's say in the late 1960s, we were watching things like Flower Power coming up. We were watching information about the Vietnam War. But the truth was, anything we saw on television did not match our reality. There was nothing to acknowledge who we were or what we were doing. And I have to say, like, that's one of the reasons why it took me so long to approach this, is that sometimes you have to have acknowledgement that it's real. One of the things that happened to me is in my 40s, all of a sudden, I had these images come up from my childhood. They were very powerful. So I started writing them down. I didn't make any comments on them. I didn't try to explain them. I just did descriptions. For me, it's creating portraits, just like I love the Innes painting. The child in this book is in portraits, and she is moving through these portraits and explaining what she sees. But, you know, I couldn't go back. In some memoirs, you go back and you explain what's going on, or you put the adult perspective. One of the things that happened for me is I never went back. So my reality did not transition with everybody else's reality who are the same age. I have a different perspective because I was cut off from it. And I really wanted to honor that. And I wanted to honor that child and the reality that she saw. So I simply put it down. That's why in the book, the child voice is completely separate from the person telling the story of the painting. But they do come together in the end.
And I really enjoyed that. I've had the chance to read several memoirs over the last year doing this show. It's not typically a genre that I had read a lot before taking over as the host. So that's been a really fun experience, just getting to dive into new genres. But I did notice that that was a little bit different than how some of the other memoirists that I've read approached it. And I actually really enjoyed that you kept them so separate. It really helped feel like I was in the story with the younger version of you and getting this really clear, almost innocent perspective of everything going on around you and just seeing what this place looked like, what the people of the area, how they lived, how they thought and operated. And you can really just focus in on that without having to stop and drag in everything from today or, you know, explain it or link it to this, that, and the other. You really just get to see the story and the place and the people and watch it come together and create this picture of your experience. And I really enjoyed having those separated like that. I thought it worked wonderfully for this book.
Well, you're an author and you know that there are things that you try to figure out to make it work. And truly, one of the things that worked for me was using the child and her walking as a way of describing place. Because ultimately, this book is a memoir of place rather than of its people. Its people are in it. And it ends up being a memoir of the people, too. But it is a memoir of place. I did that purposefully because, as I said, this is the place where the Industrial Revolution began. What that means, though, is that it's also the place that began our journey to where we are now, to climate change. It began our journey of sending rails across the United States, what is now the United States, and taking land from other people. That is what it did. This is the place that powered that. It was the first place to do that. You could say its sister was probably Pittsburgh with the steel mills, but Pittsburgh used some of the coal from our valley to smelt the steel.
Well, it's interesting to see those connections and looking at the story through the child character. She has no idea of the bigger picture of what's going on. You know, she's excited about the cookies. And I loved the scene with them making cookies. I just thought that was lovely. So I'm getting ready to do that with my daughter and make cookies for her concert. And I really enjoyed that one. But it does give you this sense of the isolation and reading it as an adult and being aware of everything else going on. That was interesting because my mind's making the connection as I read of like, oh my gosh, you know, the protections that are in place now, the everything that's come from this burst of industry and trying to manage that now. And young you in the book is just so unaware of all of it in that grander scheme, but yet she's still seeing those day-to-day impacts that even in that younger person's mind, she's seeing and noticing and like, ugh, some of this doesn't seem so great, but she doesn't have the experience and the knowledge at that point to draw those conclusions. And so you leave it for the reader to make those conclusions and connections and think through that. And I really found that very effective because it did make me stop and think on my own. And sometimes I did just have to take a break from reading and just kind of ponder all of that and then dive back into it. But I thought that and I was going to ask you if that was intentional or not. And so I love that it was and that you were planning to do it that way and you wanted to keep those separate. Because like I said, I think that was extremely effective in making this a very thought-provoking book.
I have to say there are several things going on. One is I love museums. I was a museum professional for a while. And actually, I see this book as a museum. And if you look at it, you look at the table of contents and you see that there are these seven pieces about the Innes painting. In between, there are these pieces from the perspective of the child. You're actually going in different galleries. That's how I see it. I love that you talked about the cookies, by the way. Question for you, because you've written so many books. Do you use food in your books?
In some of them, it's a pretty big focus. Yeah, especially some of my more recent writing. And I probably would have to sit and think about why that is. But that is something that I think for me growing up too, like food was a big part of family events and people getting together and seeing people I didn't see very often. And just some of the better memories, I think, of my childhood. I have a very, well, at this point, non-existent relationship with my mom. But those were some of the moments of good memories with her, food being a part of some positive memories.
And so food is one of those things that helps us ground memories. But I had another reason for using it. One of the things we haven't said is that the book has ethnicity in it. I grew up in the most concentrated place of languages and ethnicities in the United States, probably in the early 1900s, because there was so much industry. There were the garment mills and the silk mill, and there were the factories that made the records, all of the records you know, like Capitol Records. There was the lace factory. So not only was it railroads and coal and people running a city, but it was all these factories. I wanted to point out the different ethnicities in my family. It was a place where if you walk down the street, you'd hear different languages. There were different kinds of foods that people were preparing. And I feel like that was one of the interesting aspects. In this narrow place that was hidden away, we had all of the people from Europe who needed to escape for various reasons over perhaps 100 years. And they came there because they could find jobs very easily. And it wasn't that far from New York City. Another thing I wanted to say is you brought this up in the beginning, that you received books from Torrey House Press. I am the author who is writing about the East, though Torrey House is a Western-focused publisher. And where we come together is in environmental and social justice and economic justice. I love the books, and the writing is lyrical. I love what Torrey House Press does. I feel so honored by being a voice for the land. But they could see the reason why this is so important to have this book across the country is that it tells the story of how everything started when we talk about climate change. And I feel like I want to have discussions everywhere I can. I would love to see this book used that way because it's an easy read, and yet people will always be contrasting their own lives with it and learning about their own lives as they discuss.
I think that's very true. There was a lot as I was reading that struck me of some of the similarities to this area. Obviously, northern New Mexico looks very different from the Lackawanna Valley. But there were a lot of aspects that, as I was reading, like I said, seeing coal and oil and gas shut down here and that change that our county is trying to figure out right now, but also with the people. New Mexico is not the most populous state. We're pretty small as far as population, but we have a very wide range of, and that presents great opportunities, but also challenges, and that filters into so much policies and programs and politics of this area as well. And I think that there's a lot, even though you're writing about a very specific location in a very specific time, I think there's a lot that people will see reading this that resonates with them of wherever they're at and the challenges that they're facing. It's very relatable, even though it's very specific, which I think is an interesting thing because that's hard to do.
I have to imagine that in our country, when we have a shakeup, when there's some instability economically, we begin to wonder who we are because we identify our communities by our tasks, right? Mm-hmm. And so we always have to wonder who we are and who, like as you said, who are we going to be if an extractive industry shuts down? That is so interesting to think about the United States. There's a lot of that in our country.
There really is. We've got so much over so much space, so many diverse mm-hmm. peoples, so many industries. Mm-hmm. It's really a unique area to try to bring it all together, I think.
It's very hard to bring it all together.
Yeah. I knew we'd have run out of time and I'd have a million more things to talk to you about, but we are at that point. So before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask, where can people find you and the book and take the time to check out what you're up to and what your future projects might be?
Well, I have a website. It's KatherineYoungWriter.com. And Catherine is C-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E, Young, Y-O-U-N-G, KatherineYoungWriter.com. And if you go onto that website, you can find my email, KatherineYoungWriter@gmail.com. You can ask to be on my newsletter. You can sample my podcast because I've done two different programs, Writing of Land. And so you can listen to those. You can go on there and read things for free and listen to them. Black Diamonds is available wherever books sold. It's lovely if you can buy it from Torrey House Press and support them directly. I really admire the people who work there, this very small literary press who cares so much about the authors and the land that they work for.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. And I'm glad I got the chance to read your book, and I hope people take some time to go check it out.
Thank you so much, Cherie.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.